The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. This is Jesse Zerowell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zerowell, your host for the hour. Joining me today from the UK is independent journalist, researcher, and author Ian Davis. You can find Ian's work at his website, iandavis.com. That's Ian spelled I-A-I-N. You can also find his work at his Substack, iandavis.substack.com, as well as at ukcolumn.org, offguardian.org, and unlimitedhangout.com, among other places I know as well. Ian, welcome back. How are you, my friend?
I'm very well, Jesse. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's nice to be here.
Absolutely. So let me put forth a statement and then ask for your response to it. And that is that what we've seen over the past over 2.5 years now, almost 3 years, is a multi-pronged global campaign to recalibrate or remake the international monetary and financial system and to usher in a global technocracy in order to create and sustain this remade or recalibrated international monetary and financial system. And when I say global, I mean global. There is no big player nation state that is exempt from this campaign, whether you're talking about the US or whether you're talking about Russia, whether you're talking about the UK or whether you're talking about China. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, maybe the only thing I would sort of slightly add to that is that what we've seen over the last 2.5 to 3 years is an acceleration of that process. And I think that process can be traced back quite a long way. I think it's always been part of the envisaged long-term plan, if we're talking about global governance and the think tanks that often provide the agendas, which is then filtered through global governance mechanisms like the United Nations. That's always been on the cards, that eventually the, what for want of a better expression, we might call the international rules-based system, seeing as that's what our Western politicians like to call it. Or the unipolar world order, or whatever you want to call it, that has got a finite lifespan. And because it's based on a debt-based monetary system, inevitably it's got a finite lifespan. And I think that was always the people that are behind that, the institutions that are behind planning how global development is going to roll forward, have always been aware of that and have always been planning for this moment and for this period in our history. Because what we are undoubtedly seeing is a culmination of events that are enabling a transition in the balance of global power. And that is something, as I said, that's been, it's been on the cards for quite some time. We can go back many decades for people talking about precisely what is happening at the moment. And I think you're quite right to point out as well that, it is global in the sense of that every country is on board with this agenda. There are many different components to it. I mean, one of the ones that I often point towards is sustainable development. And we've just recently seen the joint letter from Xi Jinping and Putin to the, I think it's the third China-Russia summit on sustainable development, or I can't remember quite what the summit was, but you know, where they're basically reiterating the main talking points that you would have expected to have, you know, you would expect to hear from any Western politician over the last 25 years. And it's the same rhetoric, and it's not just the same rhetoric, it's the same agenda. That being said, I think there are tensions within that, you know, genuine tensions within how the game is going to be played out. But there's no doubt that the final destination is broadly agreed.
Yes, you're quite right in saying that what we've experienced over the last just over 2.5 years has been an acceleration of a campaign that's been going on for decades, if not longer. I would argue a century, if not longer. But in the last 2.5 years, the two main prongs of this campaign, or this operation, this accelerated stage of this campaign or operation, have been the COVID-19 pseudo pandemic and the ongoing war in Ukraine, which the current stage of which began on February 24th when Russia invaded Ukraine. Would you agree that the COVID-19 operation and the ongoing war in Ukraine are, in the last 2.5 years, have become the major prongs of this ongoing campaign?
Yeah, I think they serve slightly different purposes, but yeah, I would say that. I mean, I think that the you know, what I might call the pseudo pandemic was about really preparing us in terms of our behaviour modification for, I would suggest, sustainable development. You know, we need to be trained, you know, like monkeys, basically, to respond appropriately to crisis and to respond appropriately to when government issues its edicts about, you know, for things like preparing us. Essentially, you could look at it like they're preparing us for climate lockdowns, for energy blackouts, for that kind of thing. You know, it's about accustoming us to being used to that kind of stuff, which we haven't been used to over the last, you know, certainly in the first world kind of developed nations in the West, we haven't been used to that over the last 20 or 30 years, 30 or 40 years, really. But we can go back to the 1970s, to the kind of conditions where, you know, we were perhaps more used to things like blackouts and power cuts and things like that. We've already seen in France, for example, climate lockdowns, you know, saying it's too hot to go out to gather in public, and, you know, the state issuing these kind of diktats, which prior to COVID-19, I think it's extremely unlikely that the public would have. I mean, I think there was quite a bit of resistance to it anyway, but nonetheless, I think it's, you know, it would have been untenable that a politician could say that in a modern, quote unquote, democratic society. That would have been, you know, an unthinkable statement for any politician to say. But you know, with the social conditioning and the behavioural programming that came with COVID-19, people were kind of accustomed to it. So it kind of, the politicians felt emboldened to say that kind of thing. And that's the point. That was the point of it. And then I think if we move to the situation in Ukraine, which is, you know, for whatever reasons you might think are behind the decision either of Russia to go to war or of NATO to perpetuate the conditions that would inevitably lead to that war. whatever the rights and wrongs of those are, the justifications for those, the fact is that the act of fighting the war is enabling a global transition in energy flows, a global transition. I mean, one of the things in that was in the letter that, that Xi Jinping and Putin sort of co-authored today was their ongoing commitment to energy security and sustainable development. The opening up, for example, of the massive Arctic Silk Road projects, which are going to replace, the flow of energy in the opposite direction, really, from the Gulf to the West. I mean, we are looking at a complete global transformation of, for example, energy. And then we're also looking at a complete global transformation of, the basic underlying monetary system. You know, obviously, when the US seized $630 billion worth of Russian assets, in that moment, they revealed to the world, openly stated to every other nation in the world that the dollar as a reserve currency was completely meaningless and worthless. So that's a very odd thing, I would suggest, for the issuer of the global, the primary global reserve currency to do, and regardless of the circumstances.
So multipolarity has been a buzzword throughout this year, certainly since February 24th when Russia invaded Ukraine. And a lot of the talk with regard to multipolarity has been celebratory, in the sense that what we're seeing is a positive pivot from a unipolar world order led by the US to a multipolar world order, or a fair world order, as Sergei Lavrov has put it, a fair world order in which there is equal participation by many nation states, equal participation economically, politically, geopolitically, etc. But I would argue that multipolarity is a Trojan horse, and in fact necessary to recalibrate or remake the international monetary and financial system. Mark Carney has spoken about multipolarity in this regard. Klaus Schwab has spoken about it. If you want to look at somebody who has a bit of a lesser stature, I would say, than Mark Carney, or a less serious stature, Schwab being more of a globalist PR executive than anything else. But the point being that multipolarity seems necessary for the transition you just described. So can you explain why multipolarity, or what is called multipolarity, is necessary for this transition that we are very much witnessing right now?
Yeah, so if you look at the premise that the Great Reset is based upon in terms of the kind of Schwab Malloray kind of mindset, which, you know, I mean, I think we can look at the World Economic Forum's platform that they put up, which is obviously, I mean, we can trace that back to 2011 anyway, when they were first talking about these kind of global initiatives that would all come together. But nonetheless, the World Economic Forum's Great Reset website, with all its maps and its different kind of policy agendas, has been around for a while, but obviously the book came out in 2020 and kind of underpinned, I think, the thinking that was all had already been established in the think tanks for decades. But the idea is that it is the breakdown of globalization, the global supply chains, which is something that has been, we saw starting with the pseudo pandemic in particular, and then even more so during the conflict in Ukraine, that you effectively it's the balkanization of globalism. So you balkanize it into shorter supply chains, and you give each region a greater balance of global power. So each pole has a greater relative share of global power. Therefore, that means that you can then exploit the monetary system that we've currently got, which is based on a kind of global model of a globalization with these global supply chains. You can break those down into the component parts and make them individually more manageable. If you break them up we're talking about continental sized blocks. It's not like I'm talking about villages. You break them up into the continental poles, and then you can manage each one of those individually, and that enables you to maintain the kind of, you know, divide and rule aspect of it, you know, on a geopolitical global stage. You can use that, so you can have kind of Cold War type things going on. But basically what it does is it means that you can then introduce your monetary model, which in this case, you know, as the World Economic Forum are very much pushing towards, central bank digital currency, that kind of thing. You can introduce that and manage it more effectively than you could if it was this homogenous blob with 193 or so countries each vying for their part of the pie. Really only probably about 20 or 30 countries, but you get the idea. So you break it up to make it easier to manage. Then the actual collapse of the supply chains is the opportunity to rebuild. So you rebuild in the, you know, what we're going to want to call a Pax Americana pole. You rebuild in the Pax Europa pole and the Pax Eurasia pole, and you rebuild that those economic systems there, and that's where you come in to make your money. You see it in nation states. I mean, that's what nation states do. That's what the West does to countries. That's what it did to Iraq. It balkanizes it. That's what but now they want to balkanize the world.
Right. And these poles you just described, they'll be working together. There may be times when they butt heads, but overall, in terms of the international monetary and financial system, the global flow of capital and commodities, they'll be working together much as they are right now, despite the narrative we get from corporate media and from a lot of alternative media that what we're witnessing is Russia and China break away from U.S. hegemony. When you look, and you don't have to look far beneath the surface of that narrative, you see that there is so much cooperation on a daily basis. One could even argue that the cooperation has increased. And one of the most recent examples of this, the most recent glaring examples of this, is the declaration, the G20 Bali Leaders Declaration, that was signed on to by the US, the UK, Russia, China, 16 other countries, in which essentially what you could call the multipolar New World Order and its international monetary and financial system and the biosecurity and biosurveillance, the technocracy that comes along with that, all of that was laid out and signed on to by these countries, which will most likely be the countries that constitute the new poles in this multipolar world order, this new multipolar world order. So can you speak to this declaration? Because it rightfully got a lot of attention when it first hit the news. It seems to have receded quite a bit, but to me, this is a key document I think we're going to look back on as a founding document, or one of the major founding documents of the multipolar new world order.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the G20 is a very important group, and certainly if we go back to Xi Jinping and Putin's joint statement just a few weeks prior to the start of the Ukraine conflict, they very much emphasised the G20. And, you know, I mean, I think it's worth mentioning that there, whilst advocating that, the G20 was devised by and proposed by the G7 bankers. It was their idea was the G20. So if we look at the G20 is already multipolar. You've got
and
five
the
groups.
The G7 used to be the G8, which the eighth constituent was Russia.
Yeah, exactly. So Russia's been kicked out, but now it's back in. You know, mm-hmm. So Russia's, as you rightly say, Russia was kicked out for quote unquote annexing the Crimea, which of course it didn't. But anyway, so if we look at the G20, it's five poles. So you've got three poles. I think it's poles one and two are basically power poles, you might say, where where you've got countries like you've got the US and Europe and European nations, and then you've got kind of Southeast Asian nations and Russia, Eurasian nations grouped into their sort of poles that are aligned more along geopolitical lines. So there's a geopolitical agreement. You can say that there's a thread in those poles. And then the other poles are more geographical. So you've got regions of the world that are split into sort of geographical, and it's not necessarily entirely geographical. You've got Brazil in one, and you've got Australia in another. So it's not entirely geographical, but broadly speaking, that's the way it works. But it's the basis of a multipolar world. So in the declaration the interesting thing, if you listen to the Western politicians talk about it, if you listen to, for example, our Prime Minister Rishi Sunak talk about it, you would think that they'd made some sort of bold statement that they were going to, crush Russia and face up to the threats of China, which is the surface narrative that we are given. But if you look at the declaration itself, it's actually about cooperation and about building a new. The absolute agreement on sustainable development, the absolute agreement on the need to move forward with new financial systems that are going to enable sustainable development and all this kind of stuff. So we are given a surface narrative, but beneath it there is fundamental agreement on nearly every quote unquote global issue. And that is, I would suggest, that is the nature of the proposed multipolar world.
Yes. As I said, I think we're going to look back probably sooner rather than later on that declaration as a seminal document in the emergence of the multipolar New World Order. I want to get into specifics with regard to Russia and China that provide more detailed examples of this push toward a multipolar world order, especially examples derived from the war in Ukraine and what's currently happening now in China, with Chinese citizens seemingly, and I say seemingly only because I'm not on the ground and one must take what one sees and reads in media always with skepticism, leave room for questioning. We know that psyops and deepfakes are more ubiquitous than ever these days, but the Chinese citizens are seemingly fed up with the system they've been forced to live under for a long time, a totalitarian system that's accelerated exponentially over the last 2.5 years, and they're not taking it anymore, and they are responding in kind. So I want to get into, again, some specifics from what's happening with Russia and Ukraine and also with China. And I don't think the two are necessarily separate. There are connections I think we can draw between what's happening in each country, because, again, everything is interconnected here. But we need to take a quick break first, and when we come back, we'll get into that. So everybody, please hang tight, and I'll return momentarily with Ian Davis here on TNT Radio after this.
TNT Radio's Michael Parker.
Some California workers who have won a lawsuit against the Goleta Water District, which is in Santa Barbara, California. Now, the idea behind the case was that these five plaintiffs who worked for the Goleta Water District claimed that they were discriminated against for the fact that they requested and got religious exemptions to avoid mandated vaccination. The lawyer for this group, Maria Gondero, said that, "I believe that we can use it in other cases as a precedent." Aha. So each plaintiff is going to receive the $25K, and we'll take the wins where we can get them. So in this suit, the causes of action were violations of constitutional free speech, of religion, and the Fair Employment and Housing Act. So they took this to court and they won the settlement. So we will see what happens.
The program and Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hey, wouldn't it be great if life came with a remote control? You know, you could hit pause when you needed to, or hit rewind, like that time you knocked down that wasp's nest.
Uh-oh.
Or that time you forgot to roll up your windows in the car wash.
Fantastic.
Yeah, a remote control would have come in handy then. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes like managing your weight, getting active, stopping smoking, and eating healthier, you can stop prediabetes before it leads to type 2 diabetes. It's easy to learn your risk. Take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Life doesn't come with a remote control.
Yikes!
So you're on your own with the wasps. You have the power to take control of prediabetes. Visit doihaveprediabetes.org today. That's doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
As a physician, how can you look into the eyes of a pregnant woman and tell her the vaccine is safe?
It's unconscionable.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective here on TNT Radio, where we are live 24/7. I'm Jesse Zerwell, and I'm speaking with independent journalist, researcher, and author Ian Davis. You can find his work at a number of outlets, primarily at his website, iandavis.com, where he recently published an excellent must-read piece, China, the World's First Technate. He published the first of two parts of this series he's working on. And we will certainly be discussing China as a technocracy and China's role in the multipolar New World Order. I should add that Ian and I will be continuing the discussion we're having today on Friday. So if we don't fully get to China today, we will certainly do so on Friday. That said, Ian, I want to start with Russia and the war in Ukraine and highlight some examples of ongoing cooperation between Russia and the collective West, as it's been termed in alternative media. And this term was taken from Putin speak. Interesting adoption of Putin's lexicon. And I want to highlight some examples of the severely metastasizing technocracy in Russia, particularly with regard to surveillance and the digitization and centralization of human information, if I can put it that way. So the first example, while we have the constant daily news in corporate and alternative media about the war in Ukraine and its Russia versus NATO, there is cooperation going on between the United States, the EU, and Russia, in which, according to The Hill, an American news outlet, the United States and the European Union continue to shovel hundreds of millions of dollars to Rosatom, a Russian nuclear firm that maintains Moscow's nuclear weapons complex and just filched a $60 billion Ukrainian nuclear plant. Besides being in charge of all of Russia's nuclear weapons production and development, Rosatom supplies nuclear fuel to nuclear plants in the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Bulgaria, and Hungary. Any European Union decision to cut off fuel to these plants would immediately harm these states economically. So when Poland, Ireland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Germany recently recommended that the EU ban Russian nuclear imports to avoid funding Russia's military efforts, the Hungarians and French howled and Brussels blinked. Russia buys two-thirds of France's electrical steam generators. Also, French nuclear fuel fabricator Framatome just struck a major nuclear fuel development cooperation agreement with Rosatom. The piece goes on to report that with regard to the US, there are no Russian-designed reactors in America, nor is the United States without alternative uranium suppliers in Canada, Australia, and Kazakhstan, or practical near-term uranium enrichment options. Yet Washington pretty much followed the EU's playbook. Russia provides roughly 15% of America's raw uranium and 28% of its enriched uranium. Combined with Russian nuclear sales to the EU, these uranium imports from Russia fatten Rosatom's coffers by as much as $1 billion a year, easily more than Rosatom spends to maintain Russia's nuclear weapons complex. The last vital point from this piece is that only days after Russia seized the Zaporizhia nuclear plant, the Nuclear Energy Institute and Duke Power lobbied President Biden to keep Russian uranium imports coming. Failing to do so, they claimed, would risk increasing the cost of, quote, zero carbon, unquote, nuclear supplied electricity. Worse, they insisted, it would jeopardize the future of advanced small modular reactors, most of which favor using special enriched uranium. Soon after they made this plea, the White House concurred. Biden announced a U.S. embargo on all forms of Russian energy, oil, natural gas, and coal, but not on uranium. To add to that, on the technocracy front, on September 30th of this year, Putin signed Decree number 693, which has to do with the definition of an organization that ensures the development of digital technologies for identification and authentication. This decree can be found at kremlin.ru, and it spells out a technocratic leviathan of sorts that is going to be imposed on Russian citizens with regard to data monitoring, data storage, and effectively data surveillance of every aspect of their lives that involves data, which nowadays is most aspects of all of our lives. So can you speak to these two developments, if you will, or these two, this one example of serious cooperation that's still going on with regard to nuclear material and the move by Russia itself toward a technate, toward becoming a technate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that technocracy is going to be rolled out globally. I mean, that's the point. One of the reasons that I'm writing the article about China is that China was really kind of the testbed for technocracy. And that was very much backed by the Trilateral Commission and the Rockefellers, and based upon the ideas of people like, going back all the way back to the technocracy movement itself. But then obviously it was sort of promoted by people like Zbigniew Brzezinski and people like that, who become trilateralists. Then you've got a whole process going on about, you know, building that up in China. And the idea, I think, was to test it out in China and to see whether it could function. And I think it probably has functioned quite well. And what we're seeing in, with the protests at the moment in China, and you're quite right to point out, you know, how do we know, you know, the authenticity of the video feeds that we're getting from China, bearing in mind that China does have a kind of information iron curtain that it can bring down on its population and cut it off effectively from information from the outside world. So I think what we're getting from China, we need to be very skeptical about. But having said that, one of the things about the rollout of this technocratic system of technocracy, and I would suggest the idea is to create a global technate, is that it's not a fait accompli. You know, I mean, it's a plan, it's an idea, like all of these things. It's the perpetual march towards global governance is an ambition that the think tanks, the globalist think tanks, and governments and intergovernmental organizations have had for many years. It's what they want to do. It's up to
us.
And
of course, part and parcel of technocracy is the severe control of information, to the extent where you and I have to have this conversation. You and I have this conversation and have to say, well, we're not sure about the veracity of some or all of what we're seeing and reading about what's currently happening in China because of the technocratic control of the flow of information out of China.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that is one of the things that, that was part of Xi Jinping and Putin's statement, in that their ambition was to control. I think they talked about they wanted to set up a single body that would oversee the control of information globally. So, you know, that is the epitome of technocracy. That is what technocracy, a big part of it, is all about. One of the key things about technocracy is it's also about the control of energy. So it's about, the idea of technocracy was that everyone would be issued with energy certificates. Well, if we think about a commitment to net zero, and if we also think about a commitment to personal carbon wallets and personal carbon allowances, that is tantamount to energy certificates. It's the same idea. So it's not as if it's a new idea either. I mean, we're talking about something that's nearly, or more than 100 years old now. But going back to what you were saying about what, for example, Russia are doing in terms of their surveillance state that they're setting up. And there's another interesting document that came out of Russia that talks about its plans for its internal transport infrastructure, which was talking about, you know, some pretty wacky stuff. I mean, it was talking about providing travelers with 3D printed foodstuffs, about putting neural implants into customers so that you could track their movements.
And this comes directly from Russia's Ministry of Transport.
Yes, it's from Russia's Ministry of Transport, and it's they're talking about doing that now. Not right. You know, not it's not something that they're kind of like, this is something we would like to do in 20 years time. They're talking about rolling this system out now. So in preparation for that, I mean, so that is you couldn't get more kind of top down state technocratic control than that. So the idea that technocracy is limited to some sort of the envisaged technocracy will, you know, it's only the Western populations that will be subjected to it is nonsense. Especially if we consider the United Nations, for example, I've just been doing some research on Sustainable Development Goal 7, which deals with the transition of the energy system. And the United Nations openly state that the rollout of smart grids and so forth, that the pilot region for that, I think it's SDG 7.A, the target 7.A, is the Global South.
Mm.
So they're openly stating that you know, we're going to roll this system out first in developing nations. So, you know, this is something that is the idea behind it is global, and as you rightly said right at the beginning of this, every country is on board with it. So, I mean, if we look at the nuclear situation, Rolls-Royce are currently, they're very much involved in the beginning of these SMRs, these small reactors. Now, they had an agreement with Rosatom going back to 2011 for the supply of the uranium for these small to medium-sized reactors. Now, they're currently, and I am trying to find out, they are currently going through a process with the UK government where they are hoping to have, and this is their words, they're hoping to have their supply chain approved. Now, as yet, I can't find any evidence that supply agreement with Rosatom has been rescinded. So as it stands at the moment, that long-standing supply agreement with Rosatom, which Rolls-Royce, one of the UK's flagship weapons manufacturer, armament, in terms of the military industrial complex providing engines and so forth, one of their main contractors and one of the UK's flagship companies, as far as I can tell so far, has an extant long-term supply chain relationship with Rosatom.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the UK Prime Minister has just stood up in can't remember, it might have been, it wasn't Mansion House, but that kind of affair. And he, laid into China and laid into Russia as they normally do. And I think the thing that we need to appreciate, meanwhile, as you quite rightly pointed out, there are all these agreements in place for nuclear cooperation. And let's not also forget that Rosatom is responsible for Russia's nuclear arsenal security.
Right.
It has a military role, an official military role in Russia. So a defense role. So at a time when we are supposed to be having, I think most people would concede that what's happening in Ukraine is effectively a proxy war between NATO and Russia. there is significant international cooperation going on in the... And why are they focusing on nuclear power? They're focusing on nuclear power because the European transition to sustainable development is complete nonsense. And that has been, you know, the idea that Europe as a continent can power itself with windmills and solar panels is ridiculous. It's just a silly idea. And they're aware of that, which is why they've had to start rebuilding coal-fired, you know, or reopening coal-fired power plants. You've got German companies that have closed wind farms so that they can extend their mining operations for coal, because they've leapt into the furnace of you know, this breaking down the supply chains. That's very much part of the balkanization of the planet, breaking supply chains apart.
Mm-hmm.
The World Economic Forum have openly spoken about that, that's what they see as the opportunity, is the breakdown of global supply chains. So, you know, that the European Union is committed to that in some sort of Harry Kiri kind of suicide pact with you know, to completely undermine their own energy infrastructure, which forces them to then look towards nuclear fuel. So there's the EU net zero commitment, if you like, it is a policy called Repower EU, who have just reclassified nuclear power plants and gas-fired power stations as green.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so they're now green.
Well, that speaks to the sick genius of the sustainable development push, is that what is considered green or sustainable is whatever is most beneficial to that agenda. So if wind power isn't going to work, then okay, we'll reclassify nuclear power in its place as green, as fundamental to sustainable development. So it's whatever they say it is.
Yeah, I mean, there's no actual commitment to any kind of environmentalism or anything like that. I mean, that's
no.
That's just the sales pitch. I mean, there's no commitment to that at all. It's not anywhere in any of the sustainable development goals. When you break them down, it's got nothing to do with that. I mean, the idea of sustainable development is that, you know, if you look at the definition of it in the Brundtland report, the idea of it is that it will meet the needs of the poorest first and foremost. So the idea is this kind of equality and, you know, enabling, supporting the needs and enabling some sort of equality of opportunity for all people. The commitment of SDG 7 is to enable affordable, cheap, renewable energy for all, you know, access for all. Well, if you look at the cost of energy and the cost of the renewable transition, it consistently pushes the price up. And as pointed out by, because of the massive infrastructure investment that would be required to make any of this stuff work. And it has been pointed out by the German Federal Government Audit Office, who wrote to the German government in only last year, pointing out that it was pushing the poorest people in Germany, it was pushing the price of energy beyond their reach. At the same time, there was a report that came out, a scientific study that came out looking at winter deaths and excess mortality in Western Europe and Southern Europe, which just point blank said that the biggest threat to people's lives is poverty, energy insecurity, energy poverty, the inability to heat their homes properly in the winter. So this transition to renewable energy, and you have to say the sanctions that are undermining Europe's capability to be able to sustain itself in terms of its energy,
intentionally
is a direct, it's intentional and it is a direct threat to life. Mm-hmm. They are threatening people's lives, and they know that they are. And it's all based on this need and this hell-bent desire to restructure the global economy, which is something that, you know, Klaus Schwab was absolutely delighted to talk about at the G20. I mean, we might ask ourselves why he was invited to speak at the G20.
Yes, that's a very good question.
Who is he? What democratic mandate has he got?
Right. He's an unelected technocrat. And he recently spoke to CGTN, which is Chinese state media. And he said that the signing of the G20 Bali leaders declaration is a good development, a very good development. And he also said, quote, "You have to have a strategic mood. We have to construct the world of tomorrow. It's a systemic transformation of the world. The Chinese model is certainly a very attractive model for quite a number of countries," unquote. And we can get into that in our next discussion with regard to China, but the general point being that, as we've been pointing out this entire conversation, is that this system of sustainable development, of biosurveillance, of technocracy through all sorts of means, including through pseudo-pandemics, it is not just a Western problem, it's a global problem. And nothing about the war in Ukraine has fundamentally changed that. And there's a lot we can get into with the war in Ukraine itself, how it's played out, that at the very least raises questions about why certain things are being done certain ways. I would argue, we don't have enough time to get into it in this conversation, but I would argue that this war is being carried out as a careful war, in that there is death and destruction being caused, but it's enough to give the image of an all-out war without the all-out destruction that would come at the level of a war like World War I, for example, because these cooperating entities on the sides of this war, and I put sides in inverted commas, they don't want all-out destruction. They need some vital infrastructure to remain in place in order to remake or recalibrate the international monetary and financial system. So that's why I would argue you see Russia, even though it's mobilized 300,000 troops, it's saying the regions have to figure out how to equip these troops. The federal government is not providing equipment to these troops, and some of the regions can't adequately provide these mobilized troops with what they need. Why is that decision being made? What purpose does that serve? Why is Russia devoting only 5% of its GDP toward this war effort? I think these are not just questions, but choices that point to cooperation with what we've been talking about this whole time, this transition to a so-called multipolar world order that's based on technocracy and the remaking or recalibration of the international monetary and financial system. To point out one more point before we close with regard to Russia, in the decree I mentioned, it involves creating a joint stock company called the Center for Biometric Technologies, which will be based in Moscow. And the shareholders are the Russian federal government, as well as the Central Bank of Russia. So we're talking about a public-private partnership here. And that's something I think we should certainly get into in our next conversation, as well as China. But unfortunately, Ian, we are out of time for today. I thank you, though, for coming on, and I look forward to our continuation of this discussion on Friday.
My pleasure, Jesse. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Absolutely. And that's it for me today. I will be back at the same time tomorrow. Take care, everyone.